PGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 343, recorded on March 4th, 2014.
Welcome to the 343rd edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 176th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Paul S. Novak.
And I am Jordan Falcon.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry, including gaming flashback and gaming history segments.
There's no gaming history. I keep forgetting to remove that. Just a gaming flashback.
Well, the great thing about old games is that they still work when you plug them in.
Yeah. So anyway,
to that.
You might notice Paul's here, but Jordan isn't, which is sort of a flip from what's usually going on. Jordan's voice is not good right now. He has some sort of laryngitis, so he'll be back next week. But we do have Paul, and it looks like we're going to start recording on a different day of the week because it's more advantageous to Paul. And,
we'll have this whole California thing.
Yeah, we'll have a three-man crew once again. So, Paul, what have you been playing?
Sadly, I've been playing that Dungeon Keeper iOS game.
Okay.
Man, is that sad. It takes longer to load the game than it does to play.
Didn't you say you were playing a new Facebook game?
I am playing a new Facebook game. I've been playing Kitchen Scramble since it launched earlier this year, and I'm so excited because I'm almost on the last region.
Okay. So
people friend me and play that game because I need your help getting through toll booths.
Well, the thing is that a lot of people don't know what the heck you're talking about. It's a cooking game,
Scramble.
Right?
The game, it's Kitchen Scramble. It's a game from Playdom on Facebook.
Okay. And
lots and lots of fun. It's the narrative is like you're a woman starting your own food truck company or something, and you run around inside your truck making all the stuff for the customers who show up.
Sounds an awful lot like Diner Dash.
Yes, except in Diner Dash, you're mostly seating them and trying to take their order and get them out the door. This is they just walk up to you and you just make them what they want.
Yeah, but Flo actually, she has her own franchise. That's what I'm saying is that she keeps on building all these restaurants all over the place, and you're doing food trucks?
No, just the one food truck.
Oh, okay. But you're going to different locations.
Right. So the perspective view and you learn to make different dishes in these different places, like, egg rolls in Chinatown and what have you.
Right. I just finished episode 2 of The Walking Dead season 2. It was released today and I finished it in like 2 hours. I just finished just before this podcast. And I wasn't really a fan of episode 1, but I liked episode two a lot more. It ramped up the stakes, although, minor spoiler, I don't like the bury your gaze trope being used in this, because no matter what,
The I'm sorry, what?
The bury your gaze.
I would assume that would be G-A-Z-E.
No, G-A-Y-S,
Who do I fucking write a letter to?
Well, here's the thing. It used to be an old trope in which the gay at the end of the story would die from whatever. Usually it's suicide, in this case, it's not, and it's a little more tragic. I just, it isn't, and it's handled really well, but it's a trope I find a little tired, So, it's nothing to...
I understand what you're saying now. The way you were saying it before made me think that, the point of the mission was to run around killing homosexuals.
Thing is that, they die, and it's sort of like in a movie, for the most part, if there's a gay character and it's a thriller or an action or a horror movie, they're going to be dead before the second... It's sort of a variation on the black guy dies first sort of trope,
Yeah. So we've all seen The Celluloid Closet. And if you haven't, then you should.
Yeah. But in this case, at least it was handled a little tastefully. I just, I don't know. It could have been, I guess it was that you wouldn't expect them to have been lovers because, most of the people in The Walking Dead are straight, So it's sort of like one character gets
because
killed.
Because homosexuals can't form relationships?
It's just this turning. Do you know the old thing in which they have this riddle you know, that all depends on people assuming that a doctor is not a woman.
Yeah.
Sort of like the same thing here in which, you know, it says, oh, wait, of course, you know. One character gets killed, but you don't know they're related to the other character until later in the
until
story.
It's revealed that they were secretly banging.
No, they were not secretly banging. Just the new group didn't know it at the time.
There was nothing
secret about it.
Oh.
But you know the characters are at least very, very sweet. You know, so, while they were still alive. But anyway,
I'm also starting to play Royal Revolt 2 on iOS.
Have no
which
idea
is
what
interesting
that is.
Because it's a tower defense game, but you're in the attacker's shoes, so you have to run the gauntlet in order to get to the goal.
Oh, and that reminds me, I just got a brand new iPad Air.
Woohoo! New technology.
Yeah, I mean, it's light. It's very light. That's the entire point, of course. And one game is a game that I backed on Kickstarter called Republic, and it's spelled Republic, you know, the Q-U-E ending. And basically, there was this game, I forgot what it is, but this game is sort of like that, in which you indirectly guide a character through, you know, through a place where she's trying to leave, you know, and you can't directly control her. You can only indirectly control her by helping her out, by opening doors or stuff like that. Everything else, you know, so basically she's moving around and you have to help her and not get her killed, right?
So, that's interesting.
Yeah, so I've been playing that. I've also been playing a lot of Ticket to Ride on my iPad and on PC, but mostly on my iPad. It's strange because, you know, it's a board game that, I don't know. You know, Paul, I know you play Shadows over Camelot. If we get to L.A., I promise to bring my copy and we can play with the Merlin's Journeys expansion.
That is a good game. I played it once, and it was so much fun that I remember it and would play it again.
Oh, God. Then you must love the Resistance or Avalon. Well, you will love them because they're based on the same traitor mechanic. Were you the traitor?
No, I was not the traitor.
Was there a traitor? Because there is a chance in Shadows over Camelot that there might be no traitor.
I don't remember. I did what I really liked about it. It really had nothing to do with the traitor mechanic. It was more about how everyone could decide their own goals for themselves. It's like, yeah, you go do the Grail, I'm going to stop the Gauls from invading.
Yeah.
And it's like how it was kind of like it was almost parallel one player experiences for like the first half of the game.
That's basically what Battlestar Galactica the board game is like, except it's like the next gen version of Shadows over Camelot. So anyways, okay. We're going to move on to the gaming flashback. I don't know if you played this game, Paul, but I know Jordan did, which he'd probably have more to say about it. So this week's gaming flashback is Ninja Gaiden. Ninja Gaiden is an action-adventure game developed by Team Ninja for the Xbox video games console. It went through 5 years of development before it's released by Tecmo in 2004 and had a number of expansion packs and two remakes, Ninja Gaiden Black and Ninja Gaiden Sigma. The game follows the fictional story of Ryu Hayabusa, a master ninja in his quest to recover a stolen sword and avenge the slaughter of his clan. Viewed from a third-person over-the-shoulder perspective in typical action-adventure fashion, Ryu starts the game with basic low-level abilities and weapons that can be upgraded as he progresses by discovering or buying items. In keeping with his ninja persona, his character can interact with the game environment to perform acrobatic feats such as running along and jumping off walls, swing from pole to pole, or running across the water. The game was made up of several distinct regions, most of which were connected via the city of Tehran, which functions as a hub. Access to these regions are obtained by fighting enemies, finding keys, or solving puzzles, inspired by the mechanics of The Legend of Zelda video games. Dragon busts scattered throughout the regions provide the means to save player progress, permitting gameplay to be resumed at a later time, which is basically the way you're supposed to save a game. That's what it's entirely for, really. Ryu movements are directed using the console gamepad. The game's control system, which comprises of the left thumbstick, two attack buttons, and a block button, was described as fluid and responsive, and Ninja Gaiden was regarded as having one of the deeper combat engines among the Xbox games at the time, comparing well to the PlayStation 2 action-adventure God of War and Devil May Cry. Eric Williams, the designer of God of War Combat Engine, explained that Ninja Gaiden prohibits players from stopping or changing attacks mid-stroke. In contrast, God of War allows players to do so, and Devil May Cry grants us freedom in certain attacks. Williams said that, compared to those two games, the combat system in Ninja Gaiden was harder to master. However, it lets players fight the computer-controlled foes on equal terms. In 1999, Team Ninja started work on the next generation Ninja Gaiden project. The first stage of development was to create the game on the Sega Naomi Cabinet arcade system board.
I thought you were going to say the Sega Naomi Campbell.
Or Naomi Watts. Don't forget her. They planned to move the project to the Dreamcast console for further development and release, but this was abandoned when Sega announced the end of the Dreamcast product line in 2001. At this point, Tecmo decided to release Ninja Gaiden as a launch title for the PlayStation 2 in the U.S. Itagaki, however, had other plans, and the Team Ninja leader was impressed with the software development kits for the Xbox and pushed for his team to develop for the Microsoft console. The company kept silent on this change in direction and surprised both the games industry and fans when they announced at E3 2002 that Ninja Gaiden would be released exclusively on the Xbox gaming console. But that was my first E3, by the way, in 2002. Most fans who voted on Tecmo's poll wanted the game on the Nintendo GameCube, which makes sense because, you know, Ninja Gaiden had already been the original Ninja Gaiden, the 2D platforming Ninja Gaiden, you remember that was in the arcade? Wasn't that on all the Nintendo consoles?
Yep, the NES. It was a fantastic game.
Yeah. Ninja Gaiden was a Team Ninja's first action title. Its initial concept had nothing in common with the original Ninja Gaiden series that was released for the NES. There we go. However, for retail reasons, Tecmo wanted to retain a link to the previous games, which had many adherents in the West, so Itagaki was asked to rethink his ideas to target the foreign market. Analyzing the earlier games, he concluded that their violence appealed to gamers and included gory content, such as beheadings, in the Xbox games to retain that spirit. He also aimed to make this new game hard but alluring. It would challenge players on their reflexes rather than on their memories of layouts and timings. His team made a point of designing smoothly flowing gameplay with high-quality animations that reacted quickly to the player's input. Itagaki played homage to the earlier Ninja Gaiden series by including an updated versions of the foes and special attacks. Team Ninja based their 3D computer models from the pistols of the henchmen upwards on real-world material. Character models were taken from studies of the human anatomy, and the player and the team hired martial artists in order to digitally capture their movement. Rather than import the motion captures directly into the game, however, the animators used them as templates to give them a sense of realism to the game's characters' exaggerated movements. Itagaki found it more interesting to design non-human creatures than human enemies. Well, that's always true, actually. Team Tecmo announced in E3 2005 that Team Ninja was working on Ninja Gaiden Black, and later exhibited a working version of the game at the TGS 2005. Black is a reworked compilation of the original Ninja Gaiden game and the two Hurricane packs. The game includes two new foes, such as The game features new foes such as exploding bats and doppelganger fiends who can imitate Ryu. You can't go wrong with exploding bats.
Link has always found that.
Hey, you know, if the original Ninja Gaiden on the Xbox was partially inspired by Legend of Zelda, maybe that was a little shout out to Legend of Zelda. It contains more costumes than the original and swaps Ninja Gaiden's unlockable NES games for an arcade version. One key feature of this version is the two new difficulty settings, the easy Ninja Dog and the very hard Master Ninja Itagaki. Okay, that was a period there. Itagaki added Ninja Dog after receiving complaints of Ninja Gaiden being too hard in its default incarnation, although that he believed that with persistence any player was capable of completing the game. Hence, he ensured that those players selecting Ninja Dog would be subjected to gentle mockery by the game. Players on this difficulty setting would receive colored ribbons as accessories, and Ayane treats Ryu as an inferior. Well, because she's a superior woman, you know? In compensation, Itagaki made the other difficulty settings harder than in Ninja Gaiden. Another feature of Black is its mission mode, which comprises of 50 combat missions, one of which was adapted from the custom game designed for the Ninja Gaiden Master Tournament World Championship Final. The last five missions are based on those in Hurricane Pack 2 and form a Link series known as Eternal Legend. While most of the improvements made the Hurricane Pack carried forward through this game, including the camera system tweaks and the new boss battles, the intercept maneuver, introduced in Hurricane Pack 1, was not included in Black, adding to its increased challenge. In 2006, Tecmo and Sony announced the development of Ninja Gaiden Sigma for the PS3. Eidos obtained the European publishing rights for the game. Itagaki had no direct role in Sigma and judged it a flawed game, although he acknowledged that Sigma gave PlayStation owners a taste of Ninja Gaiden. A version for the PlayStation Vita, titled Ninja Gaiden Sigma Plus, was released in North America and Europe in February 22, 2012. The original Ninja Gaiden earned a 91 Metacritic score, while the Ninja Gaiden Black earned a 94 score. So yeah, this is one of those games I admired from afar, but would never dare to play. Just like Dark Souls, it looks great. There's no way I'm going to play it.
Yeah, I mean, ninja's not really my thing. I mean, I know they still carry swords and stuff, but I just kind of never really got into the aesthetic of the series.
Well, for me, it was just the difficulty level. When I play a game, it isn't because I want to have reflexes. I want it because my planning is what did it. And I know that's what they say. Well, planning is part of it. Nah, it's just hard for hard's sake is not what I want. You know, I just want something that mentally challenges me, not because I'm old.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. As we get older, the hand-eye coordination starts going.
No, it's more like,
a kid will always kick your ass in a fighting game.
No, but it's just more like, I don't want to play this again. And, I don't want to keep on trying the same thing over and over and over again.
You do get burnt out on a genre.
Yeah. So, anyways, we're going to move on to game news. Go ahead, Paul. I almost said Jordan.
Microsoft pulls page discussing Titanfall Online preloading. And this comes to us from VG247. The Xbox Store Titanfall page has announced, quote, Xbox One game expected to release on March 11th, 2014. You may download the game from Xbox Live before then, but it will not be available until 12:01 p.m.
Playable,
available, whichever. 12:01 p.m. on the release date in your country. This page showed the installation at almost 16 gigs. However, the page was removed, and Microsoft has issued a statement to Polygon saying that the page was promising preloading, quote, was posted in error, and apologized for the confusion. Quote, however, pre-purchase and pre-download for Titanfall for Xbox One will not be available from the Xbox Store, it stated. We'll continue to strike a balance between digital distribution and its benefits while supporting physical games purchased through our retail partners.
And I think that's the key statement right there. They pulled the day one digital because GameStop wanted people to buy the game from their store.
You know, I personally think that being able to preload it and just turn it on at midnight would be freaking amazing. And if you want to continue to drive people to retail stores, you might want to start looking a little bit closer at like the premium bundles. I mean, I know that I went and bought the new BioShock like Master's Edition because it came with a whole bunch of crap in it. not just even like real world crap, but like in-game crap.
You mean the DLC that was released for BioShock Infinite? I still have not played that the DLC, the one in which Elizabeth is in Rapture.
No. I mean the physical game itself. I went to the store, I got it. I got the deluxe collector's whatever edition. I didn't even mind paying for it.
Did that come with a handyman? Or it came with a statue, didn't it?
It came with a keychain. It came with some two or three in-game items.
Oh, okay.
Like I didn't, I still haven't played that much because I've been so busy working.
Did you complete the game?
I have not completed the game. I got about as far as having rescued Elizabeth and landing on the beach.
Oh, okay. That is like one third, or it's not. You're not quite at the halfway point yet. I mean, it's
See, that to me is already kind of disappointing because if that's like the one third mark, then it's like, wait, really?
No,
third of this game, and it feels like the narrative.
See, the thing is that I can't spoil this game for you, so I can't say anything more.
Then don't.
It's just
I'm gonna get to it soon. We've discussed.
I just am interested in seeing what you think of the ending. That's all.
I'll make it to the ending at some point. Is it one of those games with multiple endings?
It's one of those games. I'll just say with a mind screw ending. That's about it.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's BioShock. I kind of saw that coming, but the original BioShock, the ending changes based on, your actions in the game. So is this one of the
No, it's not a multiple ending.
I do matters. I hate that.
But I will say this, it does discuss that trope about multiple endings. it discusses it, but it doesn't have one. You'll see when you get to it. I'm not going to say anything more. I can only talk in vague terms. It'll be interesting to see what you think of it, also from a game design point of view, with the ending as well. Because there's a lot of it that caters to the art of video game. And I don't mean that, you know, it's very pretty and all that. I mean it actually, and a developer will get a message from it that maybe a gamer won't, or people who are very involved in the video game industry, you know, because it does the endings, or the ending does have messages about video game development itself that are subtle, that are not part of the actual story, but I'm pretty sure you'll be able to pull it, you know, from that perspective. You'll say, oh, I see what he's saying, you know, that sort of thing. You know, Ken.
I already found a couple of design choices that I don't agree with. I wouldn't go so far as to call them flaws or issues, but choices that I wouldn't necessarily.
Wait, what were they? What were your choice? What were the choices? Because at least that you've experienced already. It's combat?
It's more about being able to navigate my way around in this world. I think the landmarks are kind of get lost in all the rest of the beautiful art. Mm. And even the way I phrase that, like, everything is beautiful, you want to look at everything.
But there is
guides you.
I think Kevin Levine did include a button which shows you where you should be going. And the thing about
But it doesn't really provide me with the necessary feeling of understanding the space that I am looking for, the way an inset minimap would. So, I mean, I know that's a part of a different design philosophy.
Now,
I would have liked to have been able to press a button and find a map.
Were you picking up hints from the game that there's something going on, like the barbershop quartet singing a Beach Boys song?
No.
Really? Or this 1910 balanced version of Girls Just Want to Have Fun?
No, I didn't catch any of
everyone
that.
Everyone wants to save the world.
I didn't catch any of that, but you have to keep in mind I constantly turn the music off on games, and if it was, and it's BioShock, so they're talking about me, and the font size is really small, but so I have to keep the volume on, but normally I would just put it on mute and watch
the thing. Here's the thing, it's a plot point. It's a very strong plot point.
Well, then they should make it so that I have to hear it, or they should put the subtitles on the bottom. Don't force me to play your game the way you want me to play your game.
Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Report. Ouya Everywhere puts games on TV, PC without... Oh, sorry. Report. Ouya Everywhere puts games on PC and TV without the Ouya. And this comes to us from Joystick. Ouya Everywhere aims to put Ouya games on devices that aren't Ouya, such as televisions or PCs, CEO Julie Ehrman revealed to Slashdot and A-List Daily. Ehrman plans to announce details about Ouya's software initiative this week. Quote, one thing you'll start to see is Ouya and on other people's devices. We started with a $99 box, but we wanted to create a console platform that can live on other people's devices. We knew it was good enough to take us a little bit of time to get it ready. Now we think the software is good enough. It's ready to be embedded in other people's devices. We actually started having some of these conversations during CES, and the take-up was so great that we're really jumping into the strategy with both feet this year. We had signed one deal at CES, Ehrman told Slashdot. The company aims to craft a games delivery system that could be another set-top box or it could be the TV itself, she said. Ouya is talking with partners about bringing its games to the PC, and the company is quote-unquote thinking about building a Steam-like application. Porting Ouya's Android games to other platforms is conceivable, according to Ehrman. Quote, based on our strategy to bring games to gamers wherever they are, it absolutely is conceivable that we will. You know, it's funny because the Vita is doing the same thing with Vita Anywhere. So, I don't know. What do you think of this, Paul, about streaming games for a mini console?
I've been trying to keep this particular thought out of my head, but because I'm very unsuccessful. Ooh, yeah. Dot, dot. Ooh, yeah. Do it.
You know, there's other weird stuff.
Jordan would have laughed. He's a gentleman. Thank you. That's all I was waiting for.
The thing is that he has his own joke about Ouya, you know, and what's it called? He says that Ouya, wee-oo, you know, that sort of thing.
Mine's better.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's interesting. It's interesting, but it's a paradigm shift for the company. to getting out of hardware. I mean, in the same way that like Netflix is business is not about sending you DVDs anymore. It's not about, you know, having a website anymore. It's about being able to connect to all these different devices.
The thing about it is that it's basically something that just plays Android games. You know, there are some OUYA specific games, but basically we already have devices that play Android games. They're called cell phones, you know?
So wait, is your question like, what's the point of the hardware?
I'm just wondering what their strategy is about, you know.
Their strategy is getting their product, which is the games, not the hardware, into the hands of more people.
I guess. I mean, I don't think you have Android games on TV. Well, I know you don't have any Android games on TVs. But I don't think you have Android games that are on PCs. But I'm trying to figure out if it's all Android games or just OUYA Android games, because OUYA Android games take advantage of the controller, you know. So I like I said, you know, it seems like they're following the leader with Sony doing Vita everywhere, and I don't know if that's gonna work.
OUYA, da da OUYA.
Okay, you know, we're gonna move on to the next item, and I know this one. Last time you were on the podcast, you were discussing this very topic. So go ahead, Paul.
EU takes on, quote, misleading free-to-play games. And this comes to us from Ars Technica. Apple, Google, and the UK's Office of Fair Trading are meeting with the European Commission to discuss complaints and issues surrounding free-to-play games. The meeting addresses concerns from, quote, all over Europe regarding games which are free to download but which press the user to make in-app purchases. Quote, consumers and in particular children need better protection against unexpected costs from in-app purchases, said Commissioner Naveen Mimica, responsible for consumer policy, in a statement.
Hold on. You know, I have to wonder what nationality that name is.
I don't know, but it's a very pretty sounding name.
Yeah.
I like the way it rolls off the tongue.
Naveen Mimica. It actually sounds like the name of a software, doesn't it? It sounds like a game software.
It sounds like the name of a perfume. Mimica. Or an alcoholic beverage.
I think I like the perfume better.
Moving on. The main concerns being tackled during the meeting are, one, that games should not mislead consumers as to their true cost. Two, that games should not contain direct extorts to children. Exhortations. My eyes are getting old. Directs exhortations to children to make purchases or get adults to do it for them. Three, that purchases should not be debited through default settings without explicit consent from the consumer. And four, that traders need to be sellers need to be contactable via email in order to resolve queries and complaints. The discussion comes only a month after the Office of Fair Trade published its own principles for online and app-based games, which have a lot to say about in-app purchases. For example, the principles state that consumers should be told upfront about the true costs of a game or about the presence of in-game advertising, as well as offering guidance on microtransactions in child-friendly apps and advice to parents. Quote, Europe's app industry has enormous potential, but to generate jobs and growth and to improve our daily lives through innovative technology, says EU Justice Commissioner Viviane Reding, for the sector to deliver on its potential to customers must have confidence in new products. Misleading consumers is clearly the wrong business model and also goes against the spirit of European Union rules on consumer protections. The European Commission will expect very concrete answers from the app industry to the concerns raised by citizens and normal consumer organizations.
By the way, it reminds me of a story though, like 3 years ago, in which this kid ran up $500 in charges because he kept on buying brains for the zombies and Zombie Farm, you know? But, you know, for me, the fourth item is paramount. Traders need to be contactable by email in order to resolve queries and complaints. Because if you can't talk to the people who made the game about purchases, then there's something wrong.
Yeah, I completely agree with that statement. I get super frustrated when even with a larger developer like Playdom, like if you have a purchase problem or a quest problem, if you try to contact them, you got to jump through all these hoops and sign up and make an account and all of that, and then it still takes them 2 weeks to get back to you. That drives me insane.
Yeah, I mean, as far as misleading consumers about their true cost, what does that mean? It's just like, oh, you have to make an app purchase. I don't, you know, I mean, yeah, but
I mean, apps that support in-app purchases tell you.
Yeah,
and you're absolutely right. There is nothing misleading about saying a game, even a game like Dungeon Keeper, is free to play. Now, should there be possibly a scale that tells you how much more content you'll get for paying?
Yeah, but you know, the thing is that that's so fluid, though. I mean, a game will add new downloadable content at different prices. The only thing they can say is this: there's stuff that you can buy within the game. It can't go any further than that because even the developers don't know.
I completely disagree with you. I definitely think that there could easily be some kind of rating measuring a game's cash grubbiness. In the same way that we have a system in which the film industry self-polices to let you know like what is about the content of the film, we could easily be like, no, this is a very aggressive game. We are definitely wanting you.
Yeah, but people change their minds all the time.
Right. And so you change the rating.
I don't think so. And at some point, it's up to the consumer, you know, to be smart. I mean,
right. But see, here's the thing. Unless an industry polices itself, government then steps in to police the industry.
But it does police itself. It has the ESRB. It has this. It has that. You know.
Right. But apps don't usually fall under the jurisdiction of things like the ESRB.
Well, they will at some point.
I'm sure they will at some point, but part of the ESRB rating perhaps should say, you know, heavy use of microtransaction, light use of microtransaction.
Well, here's the thing is that, you know how many apps there are out there. I mean, it's almost unenforceable at some point, you know.
No, it's not.
I do like the idea of having additional gateways from you accidentally purchasing something that you didn't mean to purchase, you know. It's like, wait, are you sure what you want to buy this?
Every app I've ever played, maybe I've only have the correct settings on my phone, but every app I've ever had an opportunity to purchase in, before I made a purchase, whether intentional or accidental, it asked me to put in my password.
Oh, okay. But the thing I'm thinking of is more like a little more detail, you know, about what, you know, about before you actually make the purchase, exactly what you're purchasing and how much it's going to be and no hidden costs or anything like that, you know.
Have never once in all of my app playing years seen such a thing. I always know exactly what I'm getting, exactly how much going to cost, who it's going to appear via on my credit card statement.
Yes, but there's a lot of stupid people out there and children, so... I mean, reminds me of those...
Let's throw in a little bit of I blame the parents.
Well,
because you know what? You shouldn't be giving your kid the password to your Apple account.
You know, the thing is, I don't know. It's...
Then they can put it in whenever they want, and that nullifies the protection.
I suppose. But there are some games that just make it easy to purchase stuff. You know, like I said, that $500 worth of brains that were purchased by the kid on the app.
Who gave the kid the password?
No, there was no password. It just went through. I mean, you know. Anyway, sometimes the password is just there. You don't have to enter any password.
Well, then consumers should be educated on how to put these things properly on their phone.
But you just made my point for me.
I have never once had my iPhone fail to make me confirm my password before making an in-app purchase.
So getting back now, you've been playing Dungeon Keeper, you know, and that's one example of a game.
Oh, God, yes, I have been playing Dungeon Keeper.
In which, you know, that's, a very aggressive with the microtransactions.
Absolutely. And as is Clash of Clans. Whereas Candy Crush Saga, I would classify, even though it's making tons of money every day. I would not classify that as an aggressive microtransaction model.
I wouldn't buy Candy Crush.
Only because you could pay with your time, with your luck.
Or you don't have
to pay with money.
Or you can just play Candy Swipe, which Candy Crush Saga ripped off, which has no microtransactions, and you can just keep playing.
Well, you sound bitter now.
I don't sound bitter. I'm just saying, I'm just being a very wise consumer. You know, there's a better product out there that the other product ripped off.
Automatically force me into the position of defending King.
Okay. Well, anyway,
why should I play a game that isn't as popular? So it's more difficult for me to get extra lives just because I want to avoid microtransactions.
I don't get what you're saying. We're going to move on to the next item.
There are fewer Candy Swipe players than there are Candy Crush Saga players.
If you say so.
I say so.
Anyways, we're going to move on to the next item. Castlevania Lords of Shadow 2 studio boss. One must be blind or stupid to give it a 4 out of 10. This comes to us from VG247. Castlevania Lords of Shadow 2 studio boss Enrique Alvarez has spoken out regarding how low review scores received by Mercury Steam's latest game, Castlevania. Castlevania Lords of Shadow 2 studio boss Castlevania Lords of Shadow 2 studio boss Enrique Alvarez has spoken out regarding low review scores.
Start from the beginning.
Okay. Mercury Steam studio boss Enrique Alvarez has spoken out regarding low review scores received by their new game, Castlevania Lords of Shadow 2. Speaking with Eurogamer Spain before the expose, Alvarez was asked to comment on the low review scores, in particular, Edge's notorious 4 to 10 appraisal. Alvarez replied, "This is another important issue. There are a few media outlets that set trends, and then some other that follow them or don't dare to deviate too much. The first, Lords of Shadow, which was an 85 mark on Metacritic, also got bad scores from on some major sites, yet the game ended having a very good one. It's true that Edge liked the first game, but they didn't enjoy this one as much. I also think what happened is terribly unfair. One must be blind or stupid to give a 4/10 mark to a game with this quality. With the 4/10, people think it's a crappy game, badly done, one that's with broken gameplay mechanics and that doesn't work, and awful graphics. If I were a reviewer, I'd know this, and I don't think that Lords of Shadow 2 deserves the score of a crappy game. On how the press received the game in general, Alvarez explained, "I tend to think positive after reading some things. I'm glad that some people are writing these games instead of making them. I have to take it well, otherwise I'd do something else. But there are also people who appreciated the game. Any game is a complex work, and sometimes I think there's a lack of professionalism in the game press, who should judge things for what they are, not what they want them to be. I agree that, in the end, it's an opinion, and an opinion is totally respectable. Let's not confuse an opinion and a review. A review is about the object, and the opinion is about the subject. You can say I do really rock, but I hate opera. And this is an opinion, not a review. If I had to review Don Giovanni, I wouldn't even know where to start. And this is honestly something that's the gaming press lacks. A lot of people who review games do not live up to the game they're reviewing. This is the problem because it influences people's buying decisions, and they also influence the opportunities of the developers, because we live in a world that simplifies information and classifies developers according to their Metacritic scores. Do not misunderstand me, though. There are very good people writing about games, whatever their opinion is. I'm talking about very good people that, for example, destroyed the first Lords of Shadow. This is not about being right or wrong. This is about talking about what you... This is about talking about what you have to talk. When you say in a review that textures or the engine are not the best, or the gameplay is not up to it, you have to know it right. You can't just say, I did not like it, and I don't like it because it's bad, because that's incredibly arrogant. Alvarez also commented on why critics like the first game, but not Mirror of Fate or Lords of Shadow 2. He suggested that just because some of the members of the press and gamers perhaps dislike the game, that all subsequent impressions are tinged with hatred and resentment. Whew, that was a long...
Wow.
That was a long story. Now, I will say this. What's interesting is that I saw the game trailers review for Lords of Shadow 2, and they said that the first few hours were sort of repetitive, and but the game really flowers after that.
Okay.
And the other thing is that the Metacritic scores is that the user scores are way higher, And this is before all this edge stuff. You know, it's not like users are, you know, setting their high scores just to combat that. But, you know, it seems like the people who actually bought the game and play the game and like Castlevania are really enjoying it. So what I think, you know, when he says, you know, I can say I love rock, but I hate opera. Now, Jordan did not like Titanfall, the Titanfall beta. But he also admitted he wasn't into Call of Duty style multiplayer, right? But everybody else who has been playing the multiplayer beta, and including reviewers and fans, are loving it, loving it, loving it. So it, in some cases, it's a sense of, well, I don't like this genre, so you know, I really don't like the game. I think that's what he's saying, in effect.
Yeah, I mean, he does make some valid points, no matter how strongly he worded them.
Well, keep in mind, this is his baby. I mean, you're a developer. You understand how defensive you can be about a game that you just made.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, nothing is ever going to go completely right in a game project. But I definitely think that not every critic's word is as trustworthy as others. Personally,
I think,
I mean, and again, the same goes for film. You know, there's someone who, you know, like, let's say a Siskel and Ebert, or even, you know, who study these things from a very particular perspective. And, you know, from that perspective, they've built a brand around their opinion, as opposed to my buddy Joe, who watches a lot of movies.
And when
my buddy Joe's voice is the same volume as Siskel and Ebert's, as most of the internet is, everything's at the same volume,
yeah.
Then it lends more weight to that voice that might not be as well versed in that particular topic.
Well, I think the key is that, you know, a good game will out, you know, through word of mouth. And if the word of mouth on Lords of Shadow 2 is good enough, then people will just ignore the reviews. And, you know, because one thing that review can't do is make you enjoy a game. When you get a game, you're going to enjoy it no matter what the reviews are. You know, based on your own opinion.
I disagree with you.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I absolutely love the entire concept of Epic Mickey. And the reviews for the sequel were bad.
Dreadful.
Dreadful. I mean, poor thing, Disney's covering. But I mean, it was just bad. Like, it wasn't just like, oh, I love Epic Mickey. You know, I loved the first one. And so
that's
I'm going
to love it. That's not what I'm saying, though. I'm saying the gameplay. I'm talking about the game concept. I'm just talking about the game itself while you're playing. You know, whether the game got a bad review or a good review, that's not going to affect how you feel about that game as you're playing it. Now, if you play it and you think it's shit, you know, and the review said it's shit, well, you can go, well, yeah, it's shit. But the thing is that Castlevania Lords of Shadow 2 is not shit, you know. It may not be the greatest game in the world, but it's obviously not shit.
Well, know? Personally, I think let's examine the construct of a Metacritic scale to begin with. Well, you know, putting anything on a scale of 1 to 10 makes anything that's at like 2 through 5 seem insulting.
Well, no, the thing is that we're not talking about Metacritic here. We're just talking about specific review scores. Like, he's going off on Edge giving it a 4 out of 10.
Right, and that's kind of what I'm trying to get at. That was the point of this piece that I was looking at. It's, you know what? Sometimes it's, you know, if you don't have a scale where you know what the endpoints are, then a 4, you know, anything like 2 to 4 or 5 even is really insulting, meaning that there's only 3 points on this scale, 7 to 10, where it's considered a success.
You know what I trust?
Or good.
When a review has no score at all. You know,
really,
and it forces people to read the content of the review instead of skipping the, oh, what was the numerical score? You know, I mean, you know, someone may love the game, right? And talk about how much they enjoyed it, but give it a 7 because, you know, it feels like a 7. It's technically, I'll give you an example, like Earth Defense Force, you know, typically gets 7s and 8s because it's basically the video game equivalent of a B movie, you know, dumb but fun, right?
Right.
But you're not going to give it a 10, even though you're enjoying the heck out of it while you're playing. You can recognize that it has its flaws. So, if you don't give it a score at all, then you're just going to be talking about how much fun you're having with it, even with the flaws, you know, and people won't judge what you're saying based on some arbitrary number that you gave.
You know, I think that it just comes down to my personal sticking point on Metacritic as a whole is that, you know.
Well, didn't we have the discussion like 2 years ago in which you said that too many publishers are holding this over developers? Well, you know, your game didn't get an 85 Metacritic, it had an 84 Metacritic, so we're not going to give you your raise.
Oh, absolutely. That infuriates the hell out of me. And you know, it's even worse being a game developer. It's like, oh, not from my personal experience, but I've heard that, you know, people can't even apply to certain jobs unless their last three projects got 90 Metacritic or above. It's like, are you kidding me? You're going to put this in your job posting?
Yeah. You see how many people actually apply for that job now. Actually, you know, it's sort of like the ad that says we want someone with 20 years experience, even though they know there aren't many people with 20 years experience. They just want to weed out, you know, just everybody. I mean, if someone had it worked. And the thing is, that how do you know that the game got a 90 critic because of them, you know?
I mean, exactly. And you know what? I really do think that what I was trying to say earlier is that a five score on a scale of 1 to 10 should be considered perfectly acceptable. You got exactly what you were expecting. You were neither surprised nor angered, and it should be perfectly acceptable. The problem is, with such a competitive marketplace, that scale is skewed so that why would you spend your time on a 5 when there are so many 7s out there? And that's why I definitely think that the entire construct of putting ratings like this on a scale, any scale, not just 1 to 10, but like even, you know, how many 2-star movies do you hear about? You know, every movie is three or four stars.
There's quite a few 2 and 1 star movies lately, but I know what you're talking about. So we're gonna move on to the next item. Go ahead, Jordan. Jordan, Paul.
Jordan's not even here.
I know.
Nintendo separates quality of life business unit from consoles, and this comes to us from Game Informer. Shortly after its disappointing third quarter financial report, Nintendo conducted an investor meeting during which it revealed an upcoming focus on health and quality of life. Today, company president CEO Shiro Iwata revealed... Why did you make it pink? Okay, now I lost my place.
Just start from the beginning.
And no, Shiro Iwata revealed that the new quality of life focused unit would be separate from the traditional console division. Quote, though, through our new endeavors with the QOL improving platform, we strive to further promote our existing strategy of expanding our user base, create an environment in which more people are conscious about their health, and in turn expand Nintendo's overall user base, Iwata said. I think I said that in there twice. Nintendo has dabbled in health-related endeavors before. Wii Fit and Pokemon Walk are wearable for Soul Silver and Heart Gold. And the since-abandoned Vitality Sensor could all play into Nintendo's approach to wellness. It's likely that the health products will be tied in some ways to Nintendo's core competency of entertainment. With platform business that improves people's quality of life in enjoyable ways, we will attempt to establish a new business era apart from our dedicated video games business, Iwata writes. We have set health as the theme for our first step, and we will try to use our strength as an entertainment company to create unique approaches that expand this business.
So what it tells me is that they're going to take away all the Wii Fit stuff from the console and make it something standalone.
No, I don't really see that. I really think this is saying something very different. Just because the Wii Fit plays on the Wii doesn't mean that there isn't a viable reason for making that part of the flagship, probably even, of a separate unit within Nintendo to focus solely. Because if you're a Wii Fit kind of person, kind of player,
I
think
you have Nintendo, though. You just want the Wii Fit, right? I mean, what they're saying is, you know, the people who bought Wii Fit don't care about buying games, so we're going to make our game console, you know, we're going to concentrate on games for that. And all the health
stuff. Right, but I'm not hearing anything about this, about separating out the one piece of hardware from the other. It just seems to me that they are realizing that if you're a Wii Fit player and you're a, let's pretend they have Halo player on the same system, then you're going to be looking for two very different things. You're going, you know, it's a mistake, I think, to have one team trying to suit both of those players. You know, the more you specialize, the better a product you can make.
But you know what a Nintendo player wants? They want Nintendo games. You know, and I think they're getting tired of the Mario, you know, brand. They want something new. And I don't think, you know, being able to do Wii Fit is gonna bring more people to the Wii U. You know, I think it's a separate system that they're gonna advertise separately. You know, sort of like.
See, I don't think that'll happen because usually when they over-diversify their hardware, they run into trouble.
When have they ever done that, though? As a matter of fact, when over-diversifying, that's how they made gobs of money on the first Game Boy by diversifying. I mean,
diversifying.
The thing is that, that was their strength about the Wii, the original Wii, wasn't it?
I'm saying you're not listening to what I'm saying. When they make the mistake of over-diversifying their hardware, they run into problems.
Okay. But that wasn't a problem in 2009, was it?
I don't even remember how long.
Well, that's when the Wii Fit came out and all the other stuff, you know, and Wii Fit was a huge success.
Right.
That's what Nintendo said.
Right. And so they're having the Wii Fit on the Wii. Right? So now if you have the Wii Fit that could be work with both the Wii U and the Wii, that's one thing. You know, that's one category of hardware business. But if you can either purchase a Wii or a Wii Fit as a separate thing and they're not compatible and they don't rely on each other, I'm not really sure that's such a smart business decision. And I don't think that's what this is saying.
But the thing is that they're saying that they're going to use the health stuff to grow their audience, you know, to get a wider demographic. And I'm trying to figure out, is that really going to make a lot more people come to the Nintendo? Is that you're going to do more Wii Fit?
They're saying that this is one, their first branch of a multi-phased initiative. So, I mean, hey, do they want to take on tax accounting software and health? And like, you know what I mean? They're saying that this is for a different kind of consumer.
You can just see it now in which you have this little me that's dressed like a tax auditor and you're talking to your me about doing your taxes, you know.
But you can see what I mean. It's like they're looking at a very different consumer than a teenage boy who only wants to play Smash Brothers.
Things they had that consumer and they don't want it anymore.
Who said that? Who doesn't want who?
Well, they had the Wii Fit and they had the customer, and now those customers who were interested in the Wii Fit have moved on from the Wii
I don't think that's the case. I just think they haven't been given enough incentive to upgrade because you could still play your Wii Fit on your original Wii. They haven't been given a reason to make a change. If you want someone to do something, you have to give them a reason, whether that's video games or
But you still haven't answered my question. Is adding all this health stuff going to really make add customers to the Wii U? Is it really going to drive people to it?
But what they're saying is that this is not just health related. They're saying they're taking health and using that as the seed to build an entire new branch of what they offer.
And what would that be?
Well, not being a Nintendo insider, I couldn't tell you. But like I said, the app, if you're going to approach this situation with that kind of a mindset, then really the possibilities are endless. Why not have accounting software?
I just think the summary is that we don't know enough about what Nintendo's thinking here.
I think it's interesting. It's very vague. I think it's definitely something that we need to keep an eye on in the future.
Yeah, I mean, but the key point here is that Nintendo is financially, and you know, I'm not going to say they're in trouble, but they're having financial issues, and they're scrambling to figure out what they can do to reverse that.
They're having cash flow issues. I wouldn't say they're having financial issues.
Same difference. Come on.
No, No, it's not.
Okay, we're going to move on.
If you understood anything about the way money works, you would understand that those are
okay, we're going to move on to the next item. Project Milo isn't coming back. From IGN, Project Milo, the virtual boy used to showcase the first Kinect device when it was shown only as Project Natal, has no hope of a reboot on the new Kinect for Xbox One. Microsoft Studios VP Phil Spencer tweeted in response to a fan requesting a reboot, signaling that Milo isn't coming back. Idea was compelling, and we learned a lot creatively, but we struggled to get a full game out of it, he added. Milo was first introduced at E3 2009 as part of a short tech demo presented by then-boss of Lionhead, Peter Molyneux. It was an ambitious idea, a virtual personality that would learn and talk with you. But as time wore on, this project seemed to be slowly abandoned. In 2010, Aaron Greenberg said that development was continuing, but that Microsoft wasn't planning to bring it to market during that holiday season. Later that year, we heard reports that the team had been refocused on a Kinect Fable game, which was presumably became Kinect Fable. The Journey. The new iteration of Kinect might have been a second chance for Milo to become a real boy, given the increased fidelity of the device, but that isn't in the cards according to Microsoft. Now, wait a minute. I mean, do these people not remember Seaman? I mean, it's perfectly possible to do this sort of game with Kinect. You know, I just...
And now, this is... Just to catch me up to speed, Milo is the little boy who basically lived in your Xbox and you would just come home and play with him every day?
It was a boy in a TV and you could give him, you know, draw... You could show him drawings and stuff like that and he would talk to you. You know,
Exactly the kind of thing.
Just like sort of like a Tamagotchi, except a boy.
Your quality of life unit.
What?
This is exactly the kind of thing that Nintendo could be developing in their quality of life unit. A companion game.
I don't know. I mean,
a companion quote unquote game.
Yeah, but they had Seaman. You know, there was Seaman out there and, you know, little computer people. You know, so it isn't an unknown concept, you know. I mean, the only difference is that, you know, you have voice recognition and a scanner basically with Kinect that you could interact with it. I mean, I think it all went into doing Kinectimals anyway, to tell you the truth.
I'm not really broken up about this news. We should move on.
No, but It's just interesting to me. That's all. And Jordan would have had a lot more to say about it.
Oh, it's sad.
Okay, we're going to move on to listener feedback. Go ahead, Jordan, Paul.
I just did... Oh, no, you did that one. From Powell Predicki.
Predicki, come on.
Whatever, he's
from
new.
He's from your nationality group. Come on.
He's new. It takes me like 9 times to get their names right.
He's not new? What are you talking
about? He's new. He's new to me. I'm just coming back from leave.
Paul Prutke, come on.
At Rushed Next Gen Consoles, you're absolutely right that the media streaming functionality is painfully missing from the new consoles. I can only speak about the PS4, which is the one I got, but the fact that I can't stream stuff from my PC to the PS4 is horrible. Hashtag first world problems. However, the backlog of PS3 games is deep enough that I don't feel the need to box the console up anytime soon. No CD playback was also something I couldn't get my head around. It can't be that expensive to implement. Is it a hardware or firmware issue? Anyway, I rarely use my PS3 to play CDs. My home stereo has a CD player, so I used it instead.
By the way, but the thing is that the main point was ripping stuff from your CDs and being able to use it, you know, while playing games or as one of the radio stations in Grand Theft Auto. That's the thing that people were annoyed at. You know, you couldn't do that.
I find it very hard to get annoyed about most of these things.
Oh.
Hashtag first world problems. Poland has never had much extra multimedia support. There's no Hulu, no Netflix, no Amazon. Oh my God, you poor child. No Amazon Prime. Even the
YouTube.
Even the YouTube app has been added just recently to PS3 in Europe, still missing on the PS4. That's why it's not as bad here. I'm happy that the NHL Game Center app was available almost day one, and I can watch the games on the PS4, even though it seems to be more glitchy than the PS3 version. At Vita Multiplayer, I played some Little Big Planet on the Vita and had some connectivity problems, but not to the extent Jordan talked about. I played a lot of Killzone Mercenary, though, Platinum, yo, and it worked very well, not laggy at all. Usually full or almost full games. I played 100 plus matches needed for the trophy and got disconnected only a few times. at Sony Santa Monica. I believe I heard another podcast, but was too lazy to verify it myself. The studio is still hiring new people. One opinion I heard is that they're not only trying to cut back on costs, but also mix things up a little bit after their recent failures, i.e. God of War Ascension. That's why they laid off some people, but will still bring in some new faces, although in limited numbers. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of insights on how that stuff works legally in California, but we'll another time. At question of the week, the arcades were not very popular in Poland in the 80s and 90s. I remembered a wagon similar to a circus wagon. Oh, this is an interesting story. With some arcade games inside that we used to go to with my friends back in the day. I don't remember many of the games, though, but one of them was Cadillacs and Dinosaurs. Ah, that was an awesome TV show. There were also some metal slug machines. All the Pac-Man's templates and defenders were slightly before my time, I guess, or this era of arcade games simply skipped the communist Poland in the 80s. However, I remember playing tons of Terminator 2 pinball, but that's a different question of the week.
By the way, the question of the week, obviously, what was the arcade game that you – the coin-op arcade game that you played the most? Why don't you answer, Paul? What was the one that you played that you loved the most?
Oh my god, you mean as an actual child in the 80s?
Well, just any coin-op arcade game, come on.
Oh, I don't know. I used to have fun playing Ninja Turtles.
Okay, there you go. Yeah.
I mean, I was in like the fifth grade. That was like the early 90s. But like...
Wait.
But I remember that we had like... I remember that like the closest thing we had in my neighborhood to arcades was like the arcade room at like... Not Walgreens.
Chuck E. Cheese or something like that?
No, not Chuck E. Cheese. But it was like, it would be like the arcade room at like Service Merchandise.
Oh, okay.
Or one of those other stores. And you know what? My parents would never, ever let me go anywhere near them because they were dark and they were crowded and they were always afraid that something would happen to me. Because I was like six and I wanted to go run and play the video games.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, TMNT. I mean, I'm trying to remember what the first of those four-player beat-em-up brawlers were. I think that might have been one of the – was it either that or X-Men? I think it was X-Men that was the
first
one. It was
that. You know what? I played all of them. It was that, the X-Men, The Simpsons, and
– Well, The Simpsons was a parody of the X-Men game.
I didn't really notice it was a parody.
It was a parody because they had – they didn't. Maybe if you play it now, play both games, you see how The Simpsons was doing sort of a parody on those types of games. But in the meantime, it was a great game unto itself.
I don't view it as a parody. Okay. I can't see that connection at all, and I think it was a clone, not a parody, because they don't have special moves. But whatever.
They do have special moves. What are you talking about? I mean, you could have Bart and Marge connect for a super move, or you know, you have different character combinations you could do for super moves.
I think it was a clone. I don't think it was. I don't think it was a satire at all. I think it was a clone. It was a product that made money.
Well, that was the entire point.
It was Matt Groening selling out in the early 90s.
Okay, from Alpha Shard, at Rushed Next Game and at Rushed Next Gen Consoles. The more I hear about the lack of features and functionality of both the Xbox One and the PS4, I am so glad I chose to stick to PC gaming. I think the aspect also that you talked about with people in charge not knowing or not liking their product is very telling of the state that these consoles have come to. They are out of touch with their customer base. At Thief, this game is looking great from Let's Play videos I've seen of it so far. I find it amazing that anyone was under the impression Garrett was some sort of assassin or warrior. This is an aspect I didn't mind in the original series. You shouldn't be fighting, so getting caught and subsequently killed is the punishment. Maybe those that think like that are those who are stuck in only playing action first-person shooters. By the way, I'm having issues with Thief, but basically with level design. The level design in Thief is just awful. I mean, I don't mind the story. The story is intriguing, but you know, some of the design choices are really bad. Like, you know, you have to press Q to take someone out rather than equipping a blackjack and hitting them with it, you know? And I prefer doing that because, you know, equipping the blackjack to hit someone because it's all in one, you know, it's just attacking on my mouse. Here I have to make sure that my finger goes to the Q and sometimes it'll slip. You know, it's just clunky.
Buy a console.
Well, I didn't get the console version of Thief because I never bought a console version of Thief in my life.
Buy a console.
That's I have a console. Advice. It's called the Xbox One.
Buy a console.
Okay, at Half-Life, this is a series that I haven't been able to get into yet, but I can never figure out which was first, Half-Life 1 or Half-Life 1 Episode 1. It was Half-Life 1, and there is no Half-Life 1 Episode 1. There's Half-Life 2 Episode 1. Freeman's Mind is awesome to watch as well. A fun way to do a Let's Play, I think. At the question of the week, I love this question because I used to spend many hours in the various arcade games. I try to avoid coin gobblers like Gauntlet. I would play those that had an end goal, like Willow, Simpsons, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, X-Men vs. Avengers, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and Dungeons & Dragons. Wait a minute, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom didn't have an end goal. It just, you had a few levels and then it would repeat itself and just get harder. I loved Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, though. Did you ever play that?
No.
You should try it. I loved playing pinball machine games as well and the air hockey games. We're not going to get into air hockey. That's not a coin-op arcade game. I'll accept pinball machines, but not air hockey. Come on. Arcades aren't doing as well as they used to, though. We had one in my local mall called Nexus that even had ENPC games, but it was shut down, unfortunately. Well, the thing about the arcades was that they would always have super advanced machines that did things that were way better than consoles. Now the consoles have gotten up to them, and there is no distinction anymore. So why go to an arcade to do something that you could play on your own on machine? That's the entire point. I mean, there is the social experience. I mean, there are new arcade games like the that new Pac-Man game, that four-player Pac-Man game. But yeah. Maybe pinball machines can get, because that's something you really can't get the full feel of at home, you know, for the physical feel of doing a pinball game with the flippers and all that. Did you like pinball games, Paul?
Occasionally. It depends on the proper theming.
Addams Family?
I liked the Addams Family because the hand would come out and take your ball off.
Yeah.
I always thought that was the coolest thing.
Question of the week. We have no question of the week. So just the...
Woo! No question of the week!
The question of the week is ask us questions to answer for you. So look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net along with industry news and our gaming history article. If you enjoy our feedback, so leave us comments at our blog at GamingPodcast.net. Also hit us up at Facebook.com/GamingPodcast and the forums at GamingPodcast.net/forum or send us your comments to fans@GamingPodcast.net. You can also check out our gaming news at GameStudio.com. Also subscribe to us on iTunes and leave some iTunes comments. And Paul's game, Pin Sandy, is it still out there?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so it's on Facebook, Android, and iOS now. So, anyways, next week, Jordan will be joining us. Hopefully his voice is better by then.
Yeah, here's hoping.
Yeah. Anyways, thanks for listening.
Lord knows I can't continue to carry this show all by myself.
Anyways, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye, Bonds.